morning, everybody. I have to apologize. I'm, as you might possibly be able to tell, not very well. And as anybody who's starting a weekend slightly breathless and feverish in Brighton, I'm going to talk to you about beauty. You know, there are many forms of beauty, really. We all know this. There's personal beauty. There are beautiful people. Some of you are in the room today. Some of you are not, admittedly. There are beautiful bits of art, you know, paintings, photographs, sculptures. Objects can be beautiful. A car, for example, you know, a Ferrari could be beautiful to some of you. A shoe, a Louboutin, could be the most beautiful thing you can think of. A piece of jewelry might be incredibly beautiful. Or a building like this one, perhaps. Or the one next door, which might be either beautiful or mental, or both. Buildings can be beautiful. Music can be beautiful. Even acts, just physical acts, can be beautiful. Johnny Peacock, last night. That was a beautiful thing. Or a bit of a performance, 36 years ago, on this very stage. The pinnacle of European beauty, ABBA singing Waterloo and winning the Eurovision Song Contest. That was a beautiful thing. I'm sure we all remember it. Smells can be beautiful. Tastes can be beautiful. The first coffee you had this morning, for those of you who came from London, the first coffee you had this morning at 5 o'clock, whatever it was, that was undoubtedly a beautiful thing. And maths. Maths is beautiful. Science is beautiful. Philosophy is beautiful. Bertrand Russell, the great philosopher and mathematician and logician and so on, said that, quote, mathematics, rightly viewed, possesses not only truth, but supreme beauty, a beauty cold and austere. Scientific fact, logic, all very beautiful. Code, of course, can be very beautiful. We all know this in this room. Not just the aesthetics of source code, the beautifully indented work of some people, the beautifully commented work of some people, but code can have a deeper beauty, a beauty that you need to learn to appreciate. I'm sure everybody here knows the feeling of suddenly realizing that you know a subject well enough to understand the beauty inherent in it. That moment when you realize not just that a piece of code or a markup or whatever is pretty or effective, but the way that it's been done was beautiful, was elegant. And we all have heroes in this trade that do things in a beautiful and elegant way. Jeremy, even. We learn very quickly that there is a time and a point where we understand a subject well enough that we not only appreciate its beauty, but we understand the jokes within it. Sudo make me a sandwich, for example, is a joke that only a few people get, but it's very funny if you read it in XKCD. Or the joke about why do mathematicians get Halloween and Christmas mixed up, because Oct 31 equals Dec 25, is a joke that some people will be telling their friends later on, and others will have to have them explain it to them. In the same way as there are 10 types of people who understand binary, those who do and those who don't. Again, ask your friend. But this sort of beauty, this sort of appreciation, this sort of aesthetic sense is something that you have to fight for. You have to fight for it not only to understand the subject matter well enough, to appreciate the inner aesthetics, to appreciate the value, the sensual value of the stuff that you're doing, but we also have to fight for it to make the subject itself beautiful in the first place. This is the 21st year of the existence of the web. The web can now legally drink in America, which explains a lot, I think. We've come a very long way. We've come a very, very long way. For those of you in the room who were born in the 70s, the three of us, I think, who remember the early days of the web, remember the early days of HTML, it was a total mess. It was horrible. It not only looked horrible when you rendered it, but if you viewed source, it was disgusting. There was little beauty in any of this stuff, but over the years, the community, the development community, have pulled beauty out of it. Michelangelo, the genius artist, sculptor of the David and La Pietà and all of those other beautiful works, he once said that he didn't sculpt something, he just removed all the marble that wasn't the sculpture. And that is really what has been happening over the past 20 years. There was a very good idea hidden somewhere in the mess. And in the early part of this century, we went through years and years of those arguments and that standardization process which brought out that beauty. And we're left with a standardized world of code which is so obvious and so elegant and so gorgeous that many of us don't really remember what it was like before. It seems as if it's been with us forever, and indeed, it seems as if it was planned like that from the start. It wasn't. I think, therefore, it's worth, at these moments in time, when we seem to be reaching a new epoch in technology, a new era of the web and so on, to step back and admire the layered beauty of the stack that we work in, the fearful symmetries of XML, as William Blake would have said. At every layer that we work in, from the quantum entanglements of photons and fiber optic cables, to binary, to Unicode, to XML, to HTML, CSS, grids, design patterns, all of these things. At every level, we can find a beauty and an elegance which has been hard fought for. In fact, you could say that beauty, seeing beauty in something, is how we know it's correct. Or conversely, you might say that if you don't find it beautiful, you can know that it's incorrect. If your code isn't elegant, it's probably wrong. There seems to be a theme that runs through human achievement. But really, the standardization process was something that we were talking about, that Jeremy was writing about 10 years ago. We're kind of done with that. You can go out, you can go to the O'Reilly store outside, you can buy a book with an animal on the cover which will tell you all about it. It's 2012 now. We don't really want the browser wars back. I mean, I'd like the blink tag back. Marquee would be pretty cool. Nesting the two, that was awesome. But we don't really want the browser wars back. I still have the scars. But instead, the job today, the job for the rest of today, as you're listening to all of the other awesome speakers, and the job tomorrow, when you go home and you think about what to do with the rest of your life, now you've had your mind blown, is to make the other layers beautiful. The work's already been done up to here. All the other stuff is left to be done. What do I mean by the other layers? Well, as you know, undoubtedly TCP/IP is in a layer model, you know, the transport layer, the application layer, and so on. And and code is in layers. Style and content. But above that, you have user experience. And above user experience for the single user, you have user experience for that, for the group, social networks. And then you have user experience in what individuals and groups using that software does to society. An even higher level. What does Twitter do, for example, to an individual, to the group of people online, and to the individual's friends who are not using that application? What are these higher levels that the technology we're working with today touch? And to this day, we haven't yet really considered how to make those levels of interaction, that level of coding, that level of understanding, beautiful and elegant, and therefore true. We have become very, very enamored with the tools that we are making. And it's not surprising, because we've fought for a very long time to be able to make them. In one sense, it's like painting. It's like many people here first had to invent the paintbrush and invent pigments and invent canvas, and are now really excited that they've got these things and are trying to make beautiful pictures. But it's time to step back a little and say, okay, we're good with this technology. Now we have to pay attention to the people looking at the paintings. I'm in the middle of doing some work for the European Commission on media law. And one of the most important problems with media law across the world is a worry, especially from parents, about what does media do to the minds of their children. This is something that you'll recognize. It happens every single generation. I remember when I was yay high, it was video nasties. There would be some horror films on VHS that if children watched them, those children would be destroyed mentally forever. And then after that, it was video games. I'm sure many of you remember the fact that playing video games has turned you all into psychopaths. To use the old joke, if video games really changed the way we acted, then we would all be running about in dark rooms listening to electronic beepy music and eating pills. That obviously hasn't happened. And we tend to deny these things. We tend to say that these aren't true. We tend to sort of take the mickey out of the Daily Mail for saying that computer games drive you crazy, or Facebook gives you brain damage, or whatever the latest scare is. But at the same time, we talk about gamification and social networking and connectivity and all of these other things. We talk about attention. So on one hand, we deny the bad effects of technology, but on the other hand, we tend to embrace the potential of technologies that we're creating to have a social effect. And if we're going to do that, if we're going to talk about social software, if we're going to talk about gamification, if we're going to talk about changing the way that we live and work through these technologies, through mobile especially, then we have to come to terms with the fact that the things that we make, the stuff that we make through a little screen, actually change the world. If you work for a marketing company, then you have to at some point believe, for example, you have to at some point believe that the stuff you're doing actually works. And if it does work, then it means that web stuff, mobile stuff, all that does change society in some way. And if you're the people making those technologies, then you are changing society in some way. And if you accept that, then you have to step back and think, How do we as a community decide what to do? What is it? What values, what messages can we put out as a group of practitioners as part of that changing of society? I think there is a very obvious opportunity here for everybody in this room to genuinely change the way that the country and the world is. You see, we are living in an era which is changing so quickly that people who aren't used to that pace of change find it very difficult, in fact impossible, to keep up. Those people are usually called politicians or business leaders. Everybody in this room is undoubtedly aware of Moore's Law. Those of you who aren't, I will remind you. Moore's Law was a law created by Gordon Moore. He was the co-founder of Intel. And in about 1962, I think it was, he looked at the graph of the chips that they were putting out, the number of transistors on every integrated circuit against price, and he realized that roughly every 12 to 18 months, for the same price, the number of components on an integrated circuit would double. And he said, this is interesting. I think this might be a trend. And a few years later, he went back and it looked at it, and he realized it was. And it's remained the same trend ever since. That roughly every 12 to 18 months, for the same price, the number of components, thereby the power, of an integrated circuit doubles. Or, for the same amount of power, the price halves. This exponential growth of computing power that we're living in, that we're taking advantage of, that's making us buy a new laptop every year, that's making us curse the fact that next week all of our phones will magically become shit. Damn you. We are the first generation in the history of humanity to have exponential growth in our capabilities. We're the first generation in the history of humanity to be able to understand that. Or to understand that we don't quite understand that, which I think is perhaps more accurate. And yet we are living in a world where we are ruled over by people who don't quite understand that. We've entrusted our future to people who are confused by the present. And it is our job, really, to wrestle that future back. Because indeed we're making it, right? I hope everybody here is working on a project which they think will last for 10, 20, 30, 50 years. All the effects of which. And if you're not, start tomorrow. So we have this opportunity to really give these messages forward. And so, like I say, we have to decide what are those values, what are those messages we want to put to the rest of the world. Some people, the government, for example, I'm the Prime Minister's ambassador to Tech City. Tech City, is, of course, as you know, is Shoreditch, and the title is very good. I get a scooter with a flag, and I'm allowed to kill a man on Old Street once a year. I'm so not allowed to tell that joke anymore. I'm always getting told off. And the current government would like us very much to become singular Zuckerberg-esque supermen. To become Randian heroes. Standing alone, innovating proudly, becoming billionaires. But what we found in reality, what we've found over the past 21 years of the web is that that's not how it works. The web and web development, mobile development, code, all of the stuff that everybody in this room is into, is a communal affair. We've learned from each other. We've taught each other. We've interconnected with each other. Simon's new features just announced half an hour ago were precisely that, to allow us to become more interconnected, more interdependent, to feed off each other. And so I would like to propose that over the next day, today, and over the next week, and over the next month, and over the next few years, when you're thinking about the things that you're making, and the user experience layer, and the social layer, and the community layer, and the effect it has on the world, that you think about ways to allow your stuff to make the world more interconnected, more human, more compassionate, more understanding. There is an old Zen Buddhist story about a flower. If you imagine, there's a flower in a field, and you can admire the flower. The flower is very beautiful. And you say, is the flower flowering? What is the beauty? Is it the flower that is flowering? And you say, well, yes, the flower is the flower. And then you look at it and you say, well, actually, it's the whole plant is flowering. And you say, well, actually, hang on. That flower couldn't be flowering if it wasn't for the soil that it was planted in. So it's the soil that's flowering. And they say, well, but that soil couldn't be there if it wasn't for the field that was surrounding that. So it's the field that is flowering, and not just the flower. And then you say, but the field couldn't be there if it wasn't for the farm surrounding that. And so you say, well, it's the farm that is flowering. And the farm couldn't be there if it wasn't for the town nearby and the river going past and the infrastructure. And so it's the river and the sewers and the town and the council and the buildings that are flowering, and not just the plant. And that town couldn't be there if it wasn't for the county, and that county couldn't be there if it wasn't for the country, and the country couldn't be there if it wasn't for the island. And so it's the island that is flowering, and the island couldn't be there if it wasn't for the tectonic plate. And you get the point. For each individual flowering of brilliance, it is supported by every single other person that have influenced it. Every single thing that you have done that has been brilliant has been, yes, your creation, but has been brought about by the interconnectedness with everybody else in this room. As you'll find when you use your social networks, you'll find that everybody knows everybody else within a few degrees, and everybody has supported everybody else. All of your great work is the responsibility of everybody else here. Everybody should buy everybody a drink later. And because I'm about to pass out and possibly throw up, and because I'm freaking out the sound man by not being able to speak very well, I'm saying this to give a cue for the next person to be ready early. Over the next day, I want you to think about how to make your stuff, as I say, expose the interconnectedness, the symmetries, the genuine beauty and elegance of the community that we have created here. Deconstruct Brighton, London, the UK, Europe. This whole scene is a wonderfully rich and fertile place because we have all fed into it and continue to do so. And those values and that practice, I think, is something that the rest of the world, when it sees it happening, whether it's here or at the Paralympics last night or whatever, is truly thrilled by. As the man said, beauty is truth and truth is beauty. That is all you know on earth and all you need to know. And so I will stop speaking now and Thank you very much.